Blog Talk Radio.
Hey there, this is Annabelle. I'm really excited because I haven't done a show in a while.
And oh, you haven't?
No. So this is the first time I've done it in many weeks. And
has Eric been doing it?
No, Alberta Willis has been doing it every Saturday, and so I kind of have left it up to him. But I'm kind of restarting a series, and it's great that you're here, Linda. Thanks for joining us. It's going to be kind of like the first in a series of conversations focused on really trying to figure out what sort of tactics work for ordinary citizens who really want to be involved and who want to have a say in our government and really work towards reform. So you're the perfect person to have on. How are you, Linda?
I'm good. I'm trying to figure out how to quiet the I have the radio on in the background, and I'm trying to figure on my computer, and it's coming through. So I hope people can't hear that until I can figure out how to. There we go. All right. I think if I close this window, it will. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's
I'm
okay.
Good. I'm good. I'm glad. I'm excited to be here with you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, not figuratively, not literally.
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you for coming to our intervention last month. In the freezing rain and snow.
Oh, you guys. I mean, I felt really bad for that. I have to admit, I kind of came and went fairly quickly because I'm just not tough enough.
It was a test.
Your followers showed amazing stamina. And
yeah.
The coffee party members who showed up, I mean, I just had tremendous respect for them. It's just too bad it was such a horrible, lousy day. But it was a great event nonetheless.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was interesting because I feel like it really kind of forced us to come together as a team because it was such a trial. You know, it was like one of those like, team building retreats where you're faced with a series of challenges. So that's kind of how it felt like. I'm really eager to talk to you today about your article about the Super Committee. And kind of the assessment that you wrote out in your column in The Atlantic. The couple of points in there that I wanted to kind of focus on, one is that, you're saying that absolutely no one is surprised that it ended in failure. And so, one of the questions that I have is, was it actually designed to fail? You seem to kind of imply that it was designed to fail.
I think this is my piece, just so everybody knows, a piece that I did for The Atlantic last week, which I think they can still find.
I posted it earlier, and it's in one of the articles.
And I think, I don't know, let's say it was not designed to succeed.
Okay.
I think it would be more accurate to say it was not designed to succeed than it was designed to fail. By definition of who they put on the committee, and I make this point, it was, for the most part, quite partisan people that were put on the committee, both Republicans and Democrats, and people that would not be likely to sort of stray from the sort of partisan orthodoxy, whether it comes to not raising a single dollar in taxes on the Republican side or not touching entitlements on the Democratic side. And from everything I know about the way the proceedings went, they had very few meetings as a group. There were some behind-the-scenes sort of rump groups that met, smaller groups that met. And one of the reasons they gave for not having many large meetings is that things would get leaked to the media. And that's why they didn't have meetings. So, but it was sort of cover, I think, for the failure to really come up with a solution when the debt ceiling was raised.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't yet have a solution. We don't have a solution to this, to our major fiscal situation, which is quite dire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like there are two distinct things that are kind of coming together. One is the very serious fiscal issues that really need to be problem solved. And then there's just the general political crisis that we're in of just constant gridlock and constant campaigning and electioneering. And so it's like those two things sort of came together into a super crisis here. So,
well, they come together. Mm-hmm. What the problem is mm-hmm. that they come together now on a daily basis with Congress
right.
and
yeah.
the presidency
mm-hmm.
and make for this gridlock. I'm actually working on two pieces for this week,
mm-hmm.
one piece for tomorrow for The Atlantic on Barney Frank and his announcement, and I'll explain that in a minute, and one on Mark Warner,
mm-hmm.
And who was part of the Gang of Six and who is trying to come up with what's the next step after the Super Committee failure.
Mm-hmm.
With his Gang of Six members. And Barney Frank, I just watched the video on C-SPAN.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 40 minutes. You can watch it on C-SPAN, of Barney Frank's press conference today, mm-hmm. this afternoon, when he announced he wasn't going to run for re-election after 30-plus years in the House. And it wasn't a big part of the press conference, but during that time, he talked about the gridlock
yeah.
and the failure of the system. And that he actually, and it sort of being frustrated by it, you know, the things used to be, not even that long ago, maybe, you know, 10 years ago, that you could work. He has always been a very, you know, flamboyant, colorful, witty partisan, liberal Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
But behind the scenes, he was known for working on legislation with Republicans.
Yeah.
And now it's getting almost impossible to work in a bipartisan way.
Mm-hmm.
And he touched on that. And Mark Warner is someone who in the Senate is trying desperately to work in a bipartisan way and is sort of thwarted at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the leadership doesn't like it. It's sort of off the reservation as they see it, going and working with Republicans. And Saxby Chambliss, his Republican counterpart, co-chair of the Gang of Six, takes a lot of heat from fellow Republicans and back home for working with a Democrat
mm-hmm.
And trying to find consensus. So, and one thing that Barney Frank said at the end of his press conference, which I don't really agree with, is that he talked about how the extremes have taken over the primary process.
Mm-hmm.
And if only people would get out and vote in the primaries, it would make a difference. But, you know, in half the states in the country, you can't vote in the primaries if you're an independent voter.
Right.
So they're prevented from mm-hmm. making their voices heard in the primaries. And all they get to deal with are the candidates on the general election ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably something, you know, there are other groups, independentvoting.org and other groups that are trying to work on this. That's probably a voting, an election reform that people could work on that conceivably could help the system, you know, if independent voters in all 50 states could vote in primaries.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, let me see. I want to see if we could kind of provide some background on the Super Committee before we get into why it failed. Okay, so the Super Committee started when exactly? Do you remember when kind of their initial meeting was?
Well, I don't really know when their first meeting was, but the deal was reached to raise the debt limit
mm-hmm.
Right in early August when
okay.
They cut the deal and then went home for the August break.
Mm-hmm.
So when Congress got back in September, I don't know the exact date, but they had the first meeting of the Super Committee.
Right. And, I mean, one of the kind of questions I have is, how did this idea even come about, this idea of a Super Committee? Because it's sort of unusual, unprecedented. I've never heard of anything like it existing before. Do you remember exactly who came up with this idea and how it came to be legitimized?
You're actually asking me questions I don't know the answers to. I honestly don't know exactly which person can take credit for the idea of coming up with a super committee. I think it's based on the idea of, if you've heard of the base closure committees, and we've also had, during when Ronald Reagan was president, a Social Security committee that worked to make tweaks and changes to Social Security to keep it solvent. So whenever an issue is deemed sort of too difficult for Congress to handle, which is what I think happened here, it was just deemed too tough, too difficult because of the partisan pressures, they come up with some kind of a super body, bipartisan, bicameral that will have enormous power if they act. And this group would have had enormous power if they could have come up with a proposal. The House and Senate would have been required to vote on it, up or down, no amendments, which is a lot of power. You know, they had the potential to really do something. But I think a cynic could argue they were given so much power because no one thought they would really use it.
Yeah. I mean, so let's talk about sort of what preceded the super committee, you know, which is, you already mentioned, the Gang of Six, which was not an official committee. This was just kind of initiated by the members, but it wasn't like an official congressional committee. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Well, this goes back to, I mean, you could go back to, I mean, I don't know, you could go back years, but let's go back to last fall. Just about exactly this time last year, the president had appointed his debt commission. And sometimes it's often referred to as the Simpson-Bowles Commission. The Republican senator and Democratic, now chief of staff to Vice President Biden, had served in the Clinton administration, Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson. They were tasked with coming up with a solution to our problems, debt, deficit, entitlement, you know, impending, you know, sort of disaster as it relates to the aging of the baby boom population and entitlements. And so it was 18 commissioners, including Simpson and Bowles, and they came up last December with a very specific plan, a very extensive specific plan. 11 of the 18 commissioners voted in favor of it. According to their structure when they were created, it would have required a vote of 14. They fell just short to bring their plan to the Congress for a vote. So that didn't happen. But what did happen is Mark Warner and Saxby Chambliss last fall, while the Debt Commission was meeting, decided that this was a big problem and needed to be addressed. And so they decided that they would try to make sure that the Simpson-Bowles report did come to Congress for a vote. And they started having, this is all sort of off the record, closed door meetings with Republican and Democratic colleagues. And they, you know, eventually formed the Gang of Six, which included Warner and Chambliss, who were not on the President's Debt Commission, and four senators who were. Two Republicans, Mike Crapo and Tom Coburn, who did vote for the Debt Commission's proposal, and two Democrats, Dick Durbin and the chairman of the Budget Committee, the Democratic chairman of the Budget Committee, I'll think of his name momentarily. And so they met over months and months, many, many, many hours, and talked about what to do and what can pass and what can Republicans live with and what can Democrats live with. And they did kind of drop the ball a little bit. I mean, because it was such a hard problem, they did kind of drop the ball a little in not coming up with a specific concrete proposal in a timely enough way.
Mm-hmm.
And so events kind of overtook them.
Yeah.
And they finally came up with sort of an outline, but it was criticized as being too vague. And the president, this was in the early summer, and the president kind of gave it a hat tip, you know, in one press conference, but didn't really endorse it in the same way that President Obama, you know, a huge missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't endorse the proposal of his debt commission. He didn't sort of say yes or no, one way or the other. He didn't, you know, he could have said, yes, okay, but I don't like this, this, and this. So let's introduce it, but change, you know, the mortgage, what they want to do about mortgage deductions or whatever. And you know, there was, I think, to some extent, a certain failure of leadership all the way around on this. And so then we were stuck with, and, you know, there were the various issues about trying to get a budget all through the spring. And then, of course, we came to the crisis over the debt, raising the debt ceiling,
mm-hmm.
Which, again, is something that, you know, I argue the president should have addressed a year ago, before the new Republican Congress was sworn in, when he had a more agreeable, when the Democrats, you know, when they had that lame duck session a year ago in December, you know, he should have put that on the table, I think, and said, okay, you can have the extension of the Bush tax cuts, but we're raising the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't
do that.
Let me
ask you something. I mean, it's one of the things that you bring up in this article, that you feel like, you know, Obama has been very mysterious. In fact, you call it Sphinx-like. Not really, for instance, not really embracing the commission's recommendations, but not rejecting them, as you said. And it's I think, you know, when you say failure of leadership, I mean, it's very pointed. You are pointing to clearly to President Obama as someone who hasn't been leading on this issue. During the debt ceiling crisis and with the super committee, is that right?
Yes, I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, there's plenty of blame to go around, as I say in the piece. Certainly there's a failure of congressional leadership as well in both parties. But, yes, I do think the president has failed to lead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I sent you before the call a couple of articles with people like Ezra Klein and Lawrence O'Donnell basically saying that Lawrence O'Donnell and Randy Rhodes more than anyone else, saying that he's basically playing poker. Like, this has been part of the strategy. He didn't want the super committee to succeed. He wanted to be in a position where the automatic triggers would go off with the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the 15% across the board cuts. I mean, what do you think of that analysis? That it's not so much that he's failed; he's actually two steps ahead in the chess game.
Well, I mean, I have to say, on some level, I think they, like E.J. Dionne in his column today in the Post. I mean, they come from the left, and I think they have a liberal perspective. And they have a support the president sort of at all costs perspective. And I think I come from the center. And I think I like to think that I have a more objective view. I think I sort of call both parties on the carpet and sort of assess blame. And I think I think that might be part of it. I think there's a certain amount of this phrase has become such a cliche,
mm-hmm.
That I hate to use it because everyone uses it all the time, but kicking the can down the road on this problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's certainly conceivable that the Obama administration, Obama and his political advisors, felt that the debt ceiling morass was so negative for
mm-hmm.
everyone that he didn't want to get involved again, that he saw no margin in getting involved, that there was no advantage to that, and he would just let Congress sort of sink on its own. And the triggers, the automatic cuts, don't come for another year. They don't come until 2013. So he either will have been reelected president with a certain amount of autonomy to sort of do what he wants, or it won't be his problem. It's sort of one way or the other. So I'm sure that there was a certain amount of, there's no advantage to getting involved in these negotiations. It's going to be a big, giant mess, and why should we have our fingerprints on it? And, you know, yes, let's just push the problem down the road, and because my feeling is you can just bet they will find a way around these triggers. You can just bet that there will be some way that he has said he would veto any effort to mess with the triggers and to sort of, you know, Republicans are saying that the defense cuts are too steep in these automatic triggers, and, you know, there will, everyone will have something they don't like about these across-the-board cuts that would take effect in 2013. But I just feel confident that Congress will find a way to mess with it and to sort of weasel out of it in some way.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, the question I have is it a lack of ideas for how to solve these problems, or is it that, and so the real problem is that there are ideas and solutions, but we don't know how to execute on these solutions, or is it that we don't even have the solutions? Right, so one would be a failure of you know, an intellectual failure, and the other would be a political failure.
I don't think figuring out what to do is all that complicated. I think people know what to do; they just don't want to do it. And I said in my piece in the Atlantic on the super committee, I had a paragraph where I talked about if you gave every member of Congress truth serum, they would admit that what you have to do is raise taxes and cut spending, including entitlement reform. And that's what you have to do. And that's what the Simpson-Bowles report was, a sort of mixture of all of those things. And I got, you know, comments, you know, readers comment, and of course I got angry Republicans saying, oh no, they would never agree to raise taxes, never. And certainly I'm sure there are some Republicans who under no circumstances would agree to raise taxes and think taxes are bad and kill job creation or whatever it is that the Republican line is. But I don't think most Republicans privately feel that way. I think that a lot of them realize that we've had, you know, all these cuts in capital gains taxes, and the wealthy have done very well in the last decade, and that now it's, and we borrowed $15 trillion, and now it's time to sort of pay the piper, and unfortunately, it's not going to be pretty. Unfortunately, it's going to be, you know, everybody needs to sacrifice. And I think, and that's why I think the American people, they may not like it, but I think the American people as a whole, not the political activists on both sides, but sort of the people in the middle, the American people as a whole, understand this. And they're willing to sacrifice a little bit if everybody does it and it's equal and fair. But what they don't want is for, you know, the rich to keep all of their tax cuts. You know, the middle class is just squeezed like crazy now. And they want it to be fair. And it is going to be painful. It's not going to be, you know, because I think on some level, it's a little bit like crack or something. On some level, politicians have sold the American public on, we can borrow and borrow and borrow and spend and spend and spend and have tax cuts and, it, you know, whatever, we'll just keep going. But, the, you know, if the economy was booming, as it was in the Clinton administration, we probably could grow our way out of this, as we did in the Clinton administration. Tax revenue was a big part of how the budget got balanced. But the economy isn't growing, and so, or very, very, very slowly. And so the problem that I think is more intractable, mm-hmm. which is not exactly the question you raised, but how do we save our manufacturing base? And how do we make sure that there are good jobs for the middle class? And how do we not export all of our jobs overseas? That, I think, is a much more difficult, intractable problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have enormous economic challenges. But I guess the part where people get stuck and angry is that it feels like we've been fed a lie. We've been fed a lot of propaganda and misinformation. And so, if the Republicans were really honest about how we ended up with such a big deficit during the Bush administration, I think, the solutions would seem more palatable, right? But it just seems like, they keep kind of going, misrepresenting how we actually got to this point where we have such an enormous deficit, right? And so it's the lack of, I think, acceptance of responsibility and some kind of correction about the ideology, that taxes are always bad, that it's always about shrinking the government, right? It's always about starving the beast. That's always going to be the solution that they propose, and how that actually doesn't fit. It's just not a nuanced tool. That doesn't always fit as an answer to all these challenges that we have, right? Including the one that you just mentioned about effects of globalization and the loss of manufacturing. I mean, there are just so many sort of enormous challenges. And I think that's where people get really stuck. It's like, I think they're willing to accept these so-called the medicine, the painful things that we have to accept going forward, but, not in the situation where it feels like there's continuing kind of, rhetoric that misrepresents what actually happened.
Yes, I think that's right. I think there's a certain lack of honesty mm-hmm. by many political leaders mm-hmm. about how we got in this situation and what we have to do to fix it.
Right.
And I think that's a big part of why Congress's approval ratings are sort of in single digits.
Right.
That's why, because mm-hmm. people are sort of fed up.
Mm-hmm.
And as I went around the country and talked to people for my book on independent voters that's coming out in January, I heard the same things wherever I was. If I was in Ohio or Colorado or New Hampshire, this fundamental display, they would say, look, if I can't perform, if I don't deliver, I would get fired,
right.
But these members of Congress, and a lot about the money influence.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Republicans say, and Democrats have the people who support them too, so it's true on both sides. Yes, Republicans say any growth in government is bad, unless it's growth in government that supports people that give them money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like across the board they truly believe that growth in government is bad. Agricultural subsidies or defense contractors or, whatever it might be. I think people understand that money drives the system, that members of Congress have to raise enormous amounts of money
mm-hmm.
to run for re-election, in the tens of millions now. To run for re-election in the Senate, and that perverts the system in a certain way, because obviously people that are giving you that kind of money are looking for something in return.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
And
well, it feels like we have legalized corruption. I mean, you just made it legal. That's how
I don't know. People who are older than I am would talk about the Nixon years, and you know that there have been fixes, that actually things are not as bad as they once were in terms of people delivering, you know, suitcases of cash to members of Congress and this kind of thing. It is fairly transparent now. People can look at the FEC reports and see who's giving their congressman money, and you know they can make their own determination. But not as transparent, you know. But there's the Supreme Court ruling, which you know, third party groups are not as transparent. And we can expect. Someone was saying, and I don't know, I'm just quoting another sort of political analyst who said that they felt we could probably expect close to $1 billion on each side of independent expenditures in next year in the election cycle.
Right. Yeah. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Which is frightening.
It is terribly frightening. Well, that's kind of, you know, what I mean. Like, you know, why should that be legal? I mean, we have no idea where the money is coming from. You know, that's, I don't know. I want to kind of go back to, you know, what you were saying earlier about, you know, the things that we can work on, like improving the electoral process. Like, what are some, you know, obvious fixes? I mean, there are really entrenched problems that we have right now, money in politics definitely being one, and that's something that we have talked a lot about, you know, campaign finance reform. But this idea of, you know, actually improving the electoral process, like we haven't talked about that nearly as much as I think we should. And we have talked to independentvoting.org and other groups about that particular issue, kind of opening up the primaries. So instead of having closed primaries, having open primaries so that you can be registered independent and still vote in the primaries, right?
Yes, and I think that would be an important change, so that independent voters have the same rights as Republican and Democratic voters, especially since 40% of all voters are independents.
And it's quite growing, right? The trend is that group.
Yeah, there's more independents than either Republicans or Democrats. And in a lot of these interviews that you hear from partisans or even from journalists that I've seen in the past couple of weeks where they talk about the system, they'll say, well, the system is just a reflection of the electorate.
Yes.
The system is just a reflection of the polarized electorate, the conservatives and the liberals. But I don't believe that.
Yes.
I don't personally think the electorate is that polarized. More people are in the middle, but they're not being well represented.
Right. And you think that has a lot to do with the primary system?
Yes, absolutely. It has to do with the primary system, and it has to do with the way politicians raise money and where they get their money from. So when you think about it, what do politicians care about? They care about being reelected. So they care about raising money to get reelected and getting people's votes. So if individuals gave money, you know, now with everything being online now and with people being able to donate online, another thing, I have some prescriptions in my book about sort of how we can improve the system. And one of them is encouraging people to give small donations to, now not everyone can afford that. And I'm talking about, you know, truly small donations, you know, not over $100 or something, but, you know, having some skin in the game with members. And with politicians. And if a lot of people got together and made $50 contributions, it would be incredibly meaningful.
Right. Well, I mean, but you can attack it in, I think, you know, two ways, I think. You know, one is that it seems to me that, you know, most of the money that's raised go to advertising. You know, it's to buy, you know, media on TV and radio, right? And that really speaks to the fact that those ads actually work. It does have impact on the elections, right? And so I'm just wondering.
So, but you know, in Ohio recently, where they had the union vote, and I wrote a piece about this, and they were voting on a ballot measure to repeal, you know, the Republican legislation to weaken collective bargaining and eliminate collective bargaining and weaken the public employee unions. You know, they had an ad where they took a grandmother did an ad against the Republican legislation and said her granddaughter had been saved by a firefighter and she wants to make sure that public safety people are adequately funded and protected. And the Republican side took her words and sort of twisted them and used them in one of their ads, and there was a tremendous backlash. So, you know, I think the ads work to some extent, but I also think another thing you hear when you go around the country is that people, I don't know, people say they hate negative ads. Politicians say they work.
Yes, exactly.
So I don't really know what the answer is. Obviously, the First Amendment, you know, we can't sort of control what people put in ads. But another thing that's happening, in addition, in terms of electoral reform, election reform, I obviously would say that fighting for open primaries is a major thing. But I also think, even with the system we have, you know, Republican legislatures around the country are tightening the rules for being able to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of sort of, you know, you have to have an ID and it has to be state issued. And, you know, if you don't drive, you have to pay for it. And students, the New Hampshire legislature actually, it failed. But their legislature actually voted on a proposal to forbid college students from voting in New Hampshire, which the Supreme Court has ruled on. But, I mean, so all around the country, Texas and Wisconsin and all around the country, there are proposals to sort of make it harder for people to vote, which is a terrible thing and which people need to fight and make their voices heard on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess I'm just trying to figure out, you know, we have this opportunity right now where there is, thanks to the Occupy, you know, Wall Street movement and all the angst and anxiety we felt with the debt ceiling crisis and now, you know, with the failure of the Super Committee, there's a lot to be upset about right now. And, you know, I feel like there is an opportunity to really invite American people to be part of the solution, to lead from the bottom up, and do something really positive for this country. And I guess, you know, one of the biggest obstacles to that is you know, people are genuinely at a loss. And this is one of the things that came up when we did Lobby Day on the 31st after the rally. You know, we had these meetings with people, staffers, and I was kind of surprised to see how discouraged they felt. In fact, I would say that in some
the political staffers on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, you know, they were despondent. They just, you know, they basically said, you know, I had conversations with people who have been on Capitol Hill for decades who said it's never been this bad, and I'm at a loss.
Yep.
And so, if people on the Hill are at a loss, you know, and there's no leadership coming from within Washington, and we desperately need leadership from outside Washington, you know, where is that leadership going to come from? You know, what can we do? Because I think, you know, Occupy Wall Street has done a tremendous job of turning the narrative around and really having people focus on the substance, but, you know, staying... But occupying public square can only do so much to get the public's attention. But once we have their attention, what can we actually do about it?
Well, I think the Occupy Wall Street movement, I did a piece on this sort of after the Ohio election talking about how unions, young people, the Occupy Wall Street supporters could sort of join together to be a very powerful political force in 2012. If they could sort of unite, unions have the sort of money and organization. Young people have the numbers and enthusiasm and energy. But, you know, I think what Occupy Wall Street has done, I think, has sort of raised the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think polls have shown that a majority of Americans agree with their basic point that businesses have gotten all the breaks and the system is sort of set up to, you know, that the middle class is being squeezed and that the system is unfair.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, basic, I guess, central points that Occupy Wall Street raise. And I think a majority of Americans agree with those.
Right.
I don't think they're fans of the sort of way that, you know, they probably are not, you know, if you talk to like some suburban family in suburban Philadelphia, you know, or some, you know, worker in Ohio, they probably are not fans of the methods of Occupy Wall Street. And I think the question is, it's time for them to think about what the next phase is.
Right.
I think this, it's okay, occupying public spaces, all right, fine. All right, what comes next?
Right, but I guess what I'm saying is that I think, you know, not having good answers for what's next is symptomatic of the dysfunction of our political system and the process.
That it's such an intractable problem, it's hard to even know what comes next.
Yeah, and so if you have gridlock on the super committee,
mm-hmm.
and you have this general lack of leadership in Washington, and then to turn around and say, oh, the Occupy Wall Street people can't figure out the solutions and they can't figure out next steps, I think it's really unfair when no one seems to know the answer to that.
Well, that's a good point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think our political system does work,
mm-hmm.
in that it is a democratic system. It may be, it can be argued that it's perverted by money, but it is a democratic system, and people respond to votes. And if you look at the outsized influence that the Tea Party has had,
mm-hmm.
on the Republican Party, you can see that a movement, and the numbers of the Tea Party are not that great, you can see that a movement can have an effect. So I think if Occupy Wall Street, its supporters, union members, young people, whoever is, you know, if they had three or four things that they wanted, whether it was, you know, raising taxes on the wealthy, getting rid of capital gains, reverting back to maybe Reagan era levels for capital gains taxes or whatever, whether it was
mm-hmm.
campaign finance reform, that's a tough one. And
well,
I
agree with you, and that is kind of what we've been pushing as well, is like really drilling down to, you know, specific legislative fixes. And, you know, we wrote our position paper that really spells out some of the things that would definitely be good ideas and good solutions. But I think what's missing and what has been missing in our political dialogue has been that there's a moral problem here. There's a moral failure here in our political system that goes way beyond legislative issues, legislative fixes. You know, we have let down our the people. We have let down our ideals and our values. We have lost sight of them. And so I guess that's, and it's not reflected, our values are not reflected in our legal system. So, you know, I feel that has to be part of the discussion. So just to say, oh, well, we can drill down all the problems and come up with these legislative fixes, I don't think that's ever going to be sufficient. It's not going to be satisfying because people feel wronged,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has to be recognized instead of, you know, being told that they're deficient. You know, to have politicians say that there's something wrong with the people who are trying to stand up for what's right in their opinion, and to treat them like criminals, I think it's exactly the wrong thing to do, to try to marginalize it, when it is the majority. Majority of the people do support these views.
Well, I think David Brooks writes about this and has written about this in his last book in talking about sort of what I don't really talk so much about sort of sociological issues. You know, I don't sort of think in that way so much, and I don't sort of deal with that so much in The Swing Vote, in my upcoming book. It's more of a concrete, you know, political sort of look at things. But I think he has written about, you know, what are Americans, what is important to us now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what do we, what, you know, that sort of change in the sense of self in America, and the sort of change in values, and the change in, you know, all of these sort of issues. And, you know, yes, I think that's right. I think that has to be addressed. But I think that's a little harder to get at, you know. I don't really know how you get at that.
I think you get at it by talking about it. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, being in therapy in a way that, you know.
We need national therapy.
Yeah, we do. I think we do, absolutely. It's so much of what happens in therapy is recognizing the truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially in things like, you know, couples therapy and family therapy, I think, you know, there has to be some sort of reconciliation of the various stories that people are telling themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
they hear very different truths.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Barney Frank was saying today.
Mm-hmm.
If someone is a conservative,
mm-hmm.
and they watch Fox News and they listen to talk radio,
mm-hmm.
they hear one truth.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're a liberal and they watch MSNBC and read blogs, they hear another truth. And these two truths are very different.
Right.
And how do we square that?
Mm-hmm. Can you hang on a second? We do have a caller. I'm not sure if it's a question or not. Sometimes
sure.
Call in and to listen. Hang on. Hi there. Do you have a question for Linda? Hello? I think they're just listening. That's one of the problems with this great service, Blog Talk Radio. It's very hard to know if people are actually calling to listen or asking questions. So I'm just wondering, I mean, you know, this your view, you know, that you know, this there is a way out of this situation that would require people making compromises and kind of meeting in the middle, right?
Out of our fiscal situation.
Out of the fiscal situation.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Right. So given this intractable problem that people, there are such, you know, discrepancies in the stories that people are advancing, you know, such incompatible truths, right? I think, you know, I guess that's where a lot of people just get stuck. It's very
mm-hmm.
hard for them to reconcile and meet in the middle because they want to hang on to their truth.
Well, I'm hoping that mm-hmm. it's not going to take a financial crisis. I mean, we've already been in something of a financial crisis for the past 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for a lot of Americans, these have been very tough couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm hoping that it doesn't need to get worse. But, you know, we had a taste of this, mm-hmm. just a little hint of this, after the super committee dealings when mm-hmm. our credit rating was slightly downgraded.
Yeah.
And you can see, you know, if the interest rate
mm-hmm.
that the United States pays on its debt goes up as a result of our credit rating being downgraded, this is a little technical, but it will cost the American people billions of dollars. It's not a sort of hypothetical thing. It has very immediate and dire consequences. And I'm hoping that we don't need a sort of wake-up call. You know, obviously we're in a much stronger position than Greece or Italy or something, but Spain or... But I'm hoping it's not going to take that.
Yeah.
For our political leaders to say, we've got to wake up and deal with this. But I don't know. I honestly don't know if they can do it on their own.
What will it take? I mean, do you think that, you know, barring a major financial crisis like the one that, you know, Greece is facing, I mean, what will it take? And I really feel like we have to open up space where we can really entertain and brainstorm ideas about effective ways out of this, you know, that will involve people in Washington, people who are out on the street trying to protest, like all of us. And we have to really, you know, be willing to put our heads together and say we have this national problem that we have to solve, right? And I don't know, somehow that conversation has to get focused on solutions instead of, you know, dwelling on the past and laying blame on each other.
Well, I do think to some extent, and I do think this is to some extent the conclusion that I come to in the book, is unfortunately or fortunately, Americans need to get involved in a way that they probably haven't been.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, during World War II, for example, you know, that, I mean, obviously I'm not old enough. I wasn't born. But, you know, in World War II, all of the United States, every American got involved.
Yes.
You know, whether it was women going to the factory to work and men serving in the military and people sacrificing. You know, when you think of sacrificing today, it's, mm-hmm. you know, would people give up their iPhone for an hour? You know, I mean, back then, you know, meat was
right.
rationed, you know, and sugar was rationed, and, you know, people really sacrificed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you think about those kind of sacrifices, that, you know, the greatest generation made,
mm-hmm.
the kind of sacrifices that we have to make are not that great. And one of them is that I think Americans who have not been used to being politically active, except maybe showing up to vote
mm-hmm.
once a year,
mm-hmm.
need to invest a little more time in
yeah.
following their political leaders and making their voices heard. You know,
right.
if they
right.
could invest even a couple of hours a week
mm-hmm.
In sending emails to elected officials, in showing up at local meetings,
mm-hmm.
you know, when things are being discussed, in, you know, everybody is on Facebook and a lot of people are blogging and that kind of thing. Talk about some of these political issues with your friends. Join a group like the Coffee Party
mm-hmm.
or form another little local group.
Mm-hmm.
To talk about these issues. And again, the internet is sort of a great globalizer and a great equalizer, and it gives, you know, as we've seen with the media,
mm-hmm.
it gives people voices. It can also give citizens voices
mm-hmm.
when it comes to politics.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you, and exactly, that's exactly what the Coffee Party, you know, is trying to do. That's kind of our aspiration. But, I mean, I guess where we really, you know, confront problems is, you know, just people feeling like even if they are willing to make the sacrifices, they don't know what they can do to really be effective. They have written letters. They've even done the lobbying. They do go vote. Like, there are lots of people out there who feel like they do their part. But because of, you know, the things that really feel like it's beyond their control, like what's, you know, in mainstream media, you know, misinformation that's out there, and it's just this, the water culture problems that they frankly, you have to be made of steel not to get discouraged,
mm-hmm.
you know. That, I guess that's, you know, so I think we can go into this with that spirit of, exactly, very patriotic and very willing to make the sacrifices, but to come up with those really effective tactics and say these things will work if we all did it together. I'm a big believer in that, making that kind of collective shift and commitment, but I'm also like very aware of how difficult it is to counter the misinformation out there. And
it is difficult.
The politics of division out there.
Yes, but I don't think it's impossible.
No, absolutely not.
and okay. I think
absolutely.
There is power in numbers.
Yes.
You know?
I agree.
And I think a mistake that I think people might make
mm-hmm.
is in thinking, and I definitely talk about this in the book, is in thinking that a messiah is going to come.
Oh, yeah.
And save us. You know, that there's going to be the mythical, magic, independent candidate
mm-hmm.
who is going to have all the answers, and
right.
we have to do it ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, that to me, that's one of the biggest lessons from 2008, you know, for me. You know, this is, I think that, you know, what the discussion that we're having right now probably couldn't have taken place before the Obama campaign of 2008, where there was so much focus on the individual, regardless of what he was trying to do or say. There was so much focus on the uniqueness of him as an individual and thinking that somehow the solution is just simply getting him elected.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I think post-Obama 2008 campaign, you know, we have to have our eyes wide open that, you know, that all of us, you know, basically have to be willing to take on that kind of leadership, or else we're just, you know, headed for, as you mentioned earlier, a crisis, a bigger crisis than we're already in now.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I think another thing people can do is there
mm-hmm.
are a few good people out there, you mm-hmm. know, whether it's Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, you know, who is a Republican, but, you know, who was challenged in the primary and ran as a write-in candidate and won.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether she challenged the right, you know,
mm-hmm.
and said, I think Alaskans will elect me, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
Or Mark Warner in Virginia. Or whoever it may be, support those people in the middle. You know,
mm-hmm.
support those people who are trying to work across party lines and who are trying to find solutions, and don't support people who are sort of screaming at the extremes, you know, and don't really want to work together.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I guess, I mean, where I don't quite agree with you is the idea that, you know, that being in the center or the middle is necessarily the right thing to do, right? I think, you know, we have to balance the desire for collaboration and cooperation with things being honest and truthful, right? And there's no reason to think that the truth is always in the middle. I think sometimes it's on the right or the left, or it could be neither.
Yes,
right?
Well, that's true, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I don't, to me, believe that, you know, just, I don't have that kind of faith in the political center. Because it does keep, to me, it does keep shifting.
It does keep shifting. And one thing I think about the center
mm-hmm.
is I think some people think that it's just the mushy middle. You know, some people think that it's just halfway between Republican and Democrat. I don't think that. I think it takes the best ideas of Republicans and the best ideas of Democrats, you know. And it sort of is the idea is to come up with not just halfway, but the best solutions. You know, that's more what I think about it.
Right. I think in theory that would be right. It's just that because our process hasn't been as inclusive as it needs to be, that the people who are in conversation, who do have the megaphones, they don't necessarily represent the left clearly, you know. And I guess that's where there's a lot of discontent with the two-party system and the political process is there are many people who just don't feel heard at all
right.
by either side.
Right. And
that, like both sides
and they need
to
take
corrupt.
Matters into their own hands, you
mm-hmm.
know, start mm-hmm. a blog, start, you know, join groups like yours, start their own group of neighbors, show up at political meetings, push for campaign finance reform, push for election reform, initiate ballot initiatives. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done. It takes energy and it takes time.
I totally agree with that. Well, thanks, Linda. I'm really excited about your book, and we will definitely have you back again. When your book comes in. So thanks for joining us.
Oh well, it's been a real pleasure. You guys are doing tremendous work.
Thank you.
And all I can say is keep up the good work, and I'll look forward to
too.
Being with you again.
You too. Thanks, Linda. Great talking.
All right. Thank you, Annabelle.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today. We will be back again in about 2 weeks. Thank you.